Steady, and we are live. Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland, and like many Star Wars fans across the globe right now, we're all highly traumatized and very concerned about these fictional characters. And if it wasn't COVID, there probably would be group hugs and a lot of collective crying.
There'd be a lot of vigils being held.
Yeah. Or the other option that everyone dads up real quickly to go roll some heads. There's that option as well. So, which is, yeah. But again, people would be rightly concerned. So with that, we're here to talk about the tragedy. And as soon as that title card came across, everyone knew they were
real concern. I did a big concern.
I was like, oh no. And I watched it at 2 a.m. and had a really hard time going back to sleep. I was so concerned about these fictional characters that I'm emotionally invested in. For those who are wondering if they haven't seen us before, my name's Josh Gilliland. I'm one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is Nari Ely and Cabby Martin. And Thomas Harper is having computer trouble and will be joining us in a moment. But we're pressing forward, and Tom can swoop in like he's wearing a rising phoenix when his computer cooperates.
That would have been so cool if he popped up like right now. Sadly, we're not that efficient.
No, that would be neat, but sorry, not how we roll. Now, that being said, Gabby, you took the laboring oar on putting together an outline for tonight. And Thomas is joining us as we speak, and that is awesome.
For this hack of my computer.
Glad you made it work, buddy. So we've everyone's expressed collective concern for Grogu, and we'll speculate as after we get past the legal analysis. But let's talk about the legal issues we identified, and there are several big ones. And Gabby, you're really good at issue spotting privacy concerns. Can you help educate us on the personal identifiable information issues that we see in this episode?
Yeah, so we had talked last season about the chain code, right? That's what Mando, when he meets with the client, he asks for Grogu's, or at that point, the child's chain code. And we speculated then how it was kind of like a social security number, and how it could be tied to having a warrant. Because obviously, you know, when you're arrested and you have a warrant out for your arrest, your information is available to bounty hunters and the like to be able to secure you. And so we speculated about the privacy concerns if the child was not a fugitive, how people have this information of his. But we didn't really know what this chain code is. They just used it as this kind of identifying number or information. Now we actually get to see the chain code, and I'm probably nerding out, but I was so excited when Boba Fett shows his chain code, because I was like, aha, we finally get to see it. And I think actually we only see a portion of the chain code, because, you know, several people have already translated that chain code, which is written in Mandoa, and people have translated it, and it is kind of parsed out. He's not showing the full story. But we do see that his chain code, it not only shows his name in the top corner, but it shows his father's name, and his father's lineage, that his father is a foundling, where his father's from, the moon that his father was from, who found, Jango Fett. So it includes a lot of identifying information on, Boba Fett. And in the legal term, this is called personal identifying information. This is a term that's kind of used not just necessarily in things like HIPAA and healthcare privacy, but any, you know, workplace documents, financial documents, because personal identifying information, or PII, is any information that can be used to distinguish or trace an individual's identity, either alone or when combined with other personal information. So this is bank accounts, this is addresses, this is emails, phone numbers, anything that can kind of identify you and locate you as an individual is considered personal identifying information. So that's what this chain code is. And it seems to have a lot more personal identifying information than we initially thought, because your social security number is just yours. It doesn't necessarily inform anybody of who your parents are or where your parents are from. Not even your birth certificate necessarily does that, depending on what state you're from. So this chain code has a lot of identifying information. So it needs to be protected in a very secure way. So I'd be interested to know what the Galaxy is doing to protect these chain codes, especially it's unclear how, Bubba was able to call it up on his armor, if anybody could just call it up, or if it was specifically cued to his, DNA signature, if a FET could only be the one to access that information, or if anybody could access that information, which would be a little concerning given how much data there is in that chain code.
He's like walking around with his entire 23andMe profile, yeah, just encoded on his wrist. And I like that it was just floating out there. Like Cobb Vanth was wearing his entire genetic code laid out there. Cause we know you're absolutely right. It encodes a lot. I mean, it's would be as if one of us just carried a binder full of our genetic results, our family tree. I mean, everything short of a strand of hair. Despite the Army's best efforts to make me do that, I resisted. There's a notebook somewhere in this house that if you just got a lock of hair from me, you could probably clone me and just step into my life. But that's basically what this is on the wrist here. You know, you get a drop of blood and you can go ahead and clone him again.
I'll add a different point of view on this, that it was used to show identification. And we have biometric security, which could be a retina scan or a thumbprint to unlock computers or to go into secure facilities. And this was like having your ID information just put on there to show proof of ownership. And I agree, there are significant privacy issues with doing that. Perhaps because of the very personal nature of Mandalorian armor, that's why it was done. Maybe that's normal in their society to show where the armor came from. That being said, like the European laws that are, would like absolutely freak out over this, because family information was used to murder millions of people under the Nazis, which is why they have the privacy laws that they do today in Europe, because it's from the unpleasantness that took place. And it's on one level horrifying, but the fact that it might be normal for them makes it very alien to us.
It begs the question whether this is something that, whether from the, Galactic Senate or central government or wherever, that this is assigned and distributed to every person. And so then it begs the question, is Mando assuming some risk here by having it encoded onto his armor? Certainly he's got an interest in doing that for a variety of reasons, but is he sort of taking the risk, sort of like, I mean, not that it excuses identity theft or invasion of personal privacy, but if I walk around like with that notebook with all my stuff in it, my social security card, birth certificate, and I just fumble that and, leave it on the train or something like that, it doesn't excuse the person who takes it and commits a crime with it. But, you'd sit me down if I was their attorney and say, what were you thinking? Maybe figure out a more secure way of keeping this stuff.
And actually that's like a huge no-no with any sort of, if you are in the privacy field, one of the worst examples that people talk about in terms of breach is the idea of having a secure laptop that has PII on it. And the person sticks their password on the laptop. That is, and you lose that laptop. And that is that is different from losing a laptop that is, you know, almost that is encrypted and nobody can get the password. But if you have a sticky note that has your password on it, that is hugely, you know, there's a different burden there on whoever committed the breach. So
I believe that was actually a critical plot point in the movie version of Ready Player One.
Oy.
But not if you have the, I mean, the way to guard against that is to have the Spaceballs level encryption, just 1, 2, 3, 4, and then, you know, good luck to anybody trying to steal that.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is actually the most common password in the world, I'm pretty sure, and it's ludicrous. Anyways.
I think there's another couple other ways to look at it. You know, there is such as like a comparisons to say Judge Dredd, or I know there are other sci-fi shows that have done this where a weapon is encoded to somebody's grip and only that person could use the gun.
Mm-hmm.
If the body armor was programmed as such that only the person with the genetic match could use it, so it's like biometric security to open it as opposed to a mark of appropriation, that could be a more efficient system to show, like, you went to the you know, level of it's your ID tag that on this, and you can say, like, look, it's literally bonded to my genetic code. Well, but to go to the next level, only somebody in my bloodline could wear it would be the next level up, which would have.
But we see Cobb Vance using
it. Well, but he doesn't use the knee rockets, so that's maybe true. That he gets access to like a limited suite of capabilities of the armor, but not all the special cool stuff.
What is the Spider-Man Homecoming, the training version of the suit, and then he gets the full access.
Kill mode.
Kill mode, exactly, yeah.
Kill mode.
So, but the other thing to think about is if you have seen online the translations of what this chain code says, and we obviously don't know if he, you know, if Boba Fett could have scrolled up and seen more of the chain code, or if this is all that's there. Josh, to your point, this could be the kind of Star Wars sci-fi version of the Game of Thrones, you know, son of so-and-so, you know, from planet so-and-so. Like, it's more of a title than, you know, necessarily date of birth, you know, time of birth, all that kind of stuff. So it just depends how you look on it, look at it, but it definitely is, could be considered personal identifying information, because clearly that's how he uses it to identify himself, to confirm himself as a Mandalorian to Mando. So
I will say before we move on, because this is like fandom near and dear to my heart, and as a trivia nerd, I appreciated that within 24 hours of this episode coming out, people had not only translated the Mandoa, which doesn't surprise me much, but Wikipedia articles had been created for each entry. Jango Fett's Wikipedia article had been updated to reflect that he's now from Concord Dawn. There's like a Jaist that's mentioned, this, you know, character with no background other than I think that maybe Jango was his apprentice. He has his own stub article. So it's like the fandom delivering yet again.
It's like, well done, guys. Just well done, team. Well done. And lighters go up. And yeah, it's like clearly.
That was probably, I say 24 hours. That was probably up by like 3:38 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah.
Like there, it's like how many people at Lucasfilms have been sitting on this? Gonna do it. Now. And. Because they're big,
we got a new record.
They're big geeks too, so it's like we're gonna let it. We'll allow for one run time before we update everything. Go, yeah, like there has to be some formula they have. So again, those are the things that the lawyers immediately saw, and I thought of it as well. And Gabby, being the privacy hawk, was all over that. So we have a fascinating Jedi temple. It looks like ruins. Mando has to fly up to it. And I do have some jetpack questions I'll save towards the end, because I think that's one of the, perhaps the only real plot hole in this episode. But we have an attack on a cultural site. And Gabby, did you take the first swing at that? Or was that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, because I was thinking, so this, I'm terrible with Star Wars names, so I apologize that I do not remember the name of this planet that they are on. But this planet is considered, and I think Ahsoka mentioned it, that this is a Jedi kind of ancient site, similar to Ahch-To, similar to Jedha. So this is a cultural ancient site for the Jedi religion. And it's also, you know, it's very kind of Stonehenge in the design. You see that more in the concept art in the credits later, but it's a very Stonehenge type site. It's obviously has significant importance to the Jedi. And when the stormtroopers roll up and they just start kind of laying waste to it, obviously they don't hit the Stonehenge part, but that whole area, as we saw with Jedha and Ahch-To, can be considered significant to the Jedi. You know, we don't know how far its significance extends beyond that kind of seeing stone. So there's a customary international humanitarian law, Rule 38, which I know Thomas has talked about this before, but in times of conflict, military armies can't touch cultural sites. They're unless any property of great importance to the cultural heritage of every people must not be the object of attack unless imperatively required by military necessity. So prohibitions against destroying cultural heritage have existed since 1907, but it's only recently that international courts have begun to try individuals for this type of war crime, because it is considered a war crime to destroy cultural heritage sites, and especially World Heritage sites that are designated by UNESCO for having cultural, historical, or scientific forms of significance.
Yeah, and it goes to the principle, you know, one of the core principles of the law of armed conflict, which is distinction, and this idea and requirement, foundational requirement, that military forces, when using force, distinguish between civilian and non-civilian or legitimate military targets. And, you know, traditionally, distinction is thought of like people, right? You know, don't shoot the civilian, but you can hit the uniformed soldier. But it extends also to places, like Gabby's talking about. And a great example is this. Go back to the Gulf War in 1990, 1991, and Saddam was notorious for parking his MiGs of the Iraqi Air Force at these ancient cultural sites, these ruins and whatnot. So they had a working airfield, basically, but these jets were parked. You see it from the overhead shots, really close to these, you know, just priceless, precious, centuries-old structures. Saddam, you know, was trying to use the protection of that cultural site as an extension to protect the fighters, but also kind of trying to bait allied forces, like, hey, if you blow up these jets, good luck. You're going to piss everybody else off in the world by destroying this site. So there's sort of a dual role here. The key is that a cultural site, even though it's protected, can lose its protection if it's being used improperly by the enemy. And that would be the case of, you know, Saddam parking those jets there, the folks with ISIS and the Taliban and you know, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq were notorious for using mosques as cover to fire out of, because of the hesitancy to fire back in some cases on those structures. And the difference here, I think, is that Mando isn't using it for cover, nor is Boba Fett or Fennec. They are around it. They're providing cover. In fact, they're doing what they arguably should. Baby Yoda's up, Grogu's up, using the site for its intended purpose, using that seeing stone. They push out of the site. They're not using, you know, the Stonehenge parts, the vertical parts for cover, or, you know, waving off and saying, hey, I dare you to shoot us here. This is an ancient Jedi temple and the New Republic's going to be real mad at you for this. They push out. And, you know, that's you know, as best as you can, what you want to see an enemy force do so that you don't have to go in. And so the fact that, you know, some stray blaster bolts or maybe a mortar or two happen to go up there, I think is sort of a collateral effect of this battle. The troopers aren't intentionally targeting the cultural site in this example. So it's a good distinction from what you can see in battle sometimes.
And I have talked a lot about this, particularly in, I think, reference to kaiju stuff, but where there is a lot of civilian damage that happens. But it's important to remember that the distinction here is what's being targeted. So it's the same with civilians, right? So it's not actually true that every time a civilian dies in a military operation, a war crime was committed. And what makes it a war crime is whether or not it was either, you know, not a military target, they just targeted the civilian, or you could also argue that it wasn't the use of force there that resulted in all the collateral damage wasn't proportional to the military necessity that was at issue. But moving on, I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
I would also opine that with the Persian Gulf example, it's we can target the runway and make that a big crater, and it's like you can't take off. Luckily, When Moff Gideon rains fire, they don't target the Jedi temple itself. They go after the Razor Crest.
It's proportionality in action.
Is a cultural artifact at this point.
Yeah.
Is that?
I'll allow it. Hurt when I saw that.
Yes.
Yeah, it bothered me. It bothered me a lot, and it was like
that's the tragedy.
The fact that they were willing to blow up the ship that's become the icon or one of the icons of the show highlights that everything's on the table, that the risks are real. It's like when you bump off a character that you thought was important, it's like, oh, this is anyone can go. So they're
we're in Game of Thrones stakes here, people.
It also highlights continued similarity, in my opinion, to the Odyssey, where Odysseus does lose his ship at least once.
Yes.
It's
I'm leaving my Lego Razor Crest unbuilt now because that's what's screen accurate now. So I've completed that model. It's done.
Yeah.
I'll just pile the pieces on the shelf.
Yeah. On top of the shift though, so that you can separate that and give it to Baby Yoda.
That and like a little stick representing the Beskar spear.
Yeah, there's a So brings us to the issue of lost property. We've had lots of fun with lost property in Star Wars before. This is included who's the rightful owner of R2-D2 and C-3PO, or the what we will call Rey's lightsaber that had been Anakin's lightsaber, that had been Luke's lightsaber, then Finn was the Bailey of the lightsaber, and then it was Rey's. So, and there's a lot.
Finish buried it in the sand.
Which is just wrong. But again, another. Won't go there. We're going to focus on the lost property issue here. And I'll set it up and then everyone can dig in. So Return of the Jedi, we see Boba Fett go out like a punk. And it's why I thought Boba Fett had been overrated. And I was a kid who had Slave One, who spent lots of hours running around the backyard having dogfights because it was a cool ship. And Boba Fett was a cool looking character. But like IG-88, we didn't see him do anything of substance in the original trilogy. They fixed that. Like the way they fixed an IG unit just standing there. Problem solved. And you can tell that nerds work on this show from how they wrote it. So Boba Fett goes into the Sarlacc pit. Boba Fett somehow gets out of the Sarlacc pit. And we see that he looks pretty burned by acid all over. Yeah. So that had to be super uncomfortable.
The Sarlacc digests hair first. That's the first thing in a thousand years.
Yeah,
apparently.
And eyebrows. Yeah, it's brutal. Heck of a way to get rid of back hair. But that's not important right now. What is important is he got out and somehow got separated from his armor. We don't know that part of the story. Did he get out and because he was covered in acidic goo, you know, stripped down? Was he recovered by somebody? There's a lot of facts that are just unknown. But he got out and the armor was separated from his person somehow. Facts unknown. Jawas get the armor, and there are issues of had it been abandoned, had it been lost. So much of that depends on why he did the striptease with the body armor. But something happened. He took it off. And then it took him 7 years after Return of the Jedi for him to get to the part of Tatooine where we have the Marshal hanging out. So is it that big of a... I mean, he still had a ship. Why did it take that long? So we have a 7-year...
And he knew who had it. Because yeah. He's like, the armor that Cobb Vanth had. It was like... Why didn't you get it from him?
I'm going to charitably interpret
Krayt dragon.
Yeah.
I'm going to charitably interpret it that he has been on the trail of the armor for a while, and that's why he knew Cobb Vanth had it, which is how he eventually started tracking the Mandalorian to get it. I'm also going to maybe charitably assume that he didn't have access to Slave One the whole time. Maybe he's been spending the last couple, you know, several years piecing together his old life.
Again, highly traumatized after being ingested for God knows how long.
He's been through some things, guys. We need to cut him some slack.
This is true.
I don't know if he had...
I'd like to think it was just parked and dusty at Jabba's palace and he had to go get a new battery for it and get a jump.
Yeah, like, was he just hanging out there? It's like, did he like crawl back there? Like everyone's gone and he's just hanging out. You know,
keys are still under the visor.
Like, I need new clothes. These are ruined. You know, like was it? Yeah, did the Jawas steal it from the wash? Like, what happened here? Is it out on clothesline, and they got the body armor that way? So again, there's some weirdness.
I tend to think, and this is just pure speculation, that because we get confirmed that Boba's armor is Beskar. And we've seen how indestructible Beskar is in The Mandalorian. And so what could have theoretically happened is, you know, because as soon as Boba Fett goes into the Sarlacc pit, you know, things are resolved and, you know, everybody kind of leaves the area. So the Sarlacc could have easily, because of the indestructibility of the Beskar, chucked that back up, kept the person, and he
the edible portions
inside. And remember, because they make a point to say that the Krayt dragon is living in an abandoned Sarlacc pit, and so and they say, well, how do you get an empty Sarlacc pit? And I was like, well, because the Krayt dragon ate the Sarlacc. And so maybe this in between that, you know, eating Boba somehow escapes, and that begins his journey to recovery. Because obviously, when you get spit out of wherever you are in a Sarlacc digestion system, it's not too well for you. And so, obviously, if the Sarlacc had already regurgitated the armor, you know, the Jawas were on that stuff like that. And so they carried it away. And so now he's had to come back to his, you know, recover. Come back to his armor, and so that
probably needs to spend at least one night in a back to tank.
That back to spray, he needs that back to spray that IG has.
And a lot of it. But that would that's like saying the Sarlacc has the ability to tie a cherry stem in a knot with its tongue. And
he's got 1,000 years to work on it. He can take his time.
I could probably tie a cherry stick into a bow tie if I had 1,000 years.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you qualified that because again, we're not going to ask for, you know, demonstration.
No.
Like, no one has to do that, Tom. I'm looking at you, but you know, like, not a requirement. But that takes work and. To spit out just the armor and keep the guy.
Or he could have. I mean, you know, I think what we're looking at here is whether it's lost or abandoned. There's also the possibility that he made his way out of it and was just out cold mm-hmm. and got stripped of his armor, mm-hmm. unbeknownst to him. And I think, you know, then you're out of the realm of whether it's lost or abandoned property, and then you're talking a straight larceny at that mm-hmm. point. But, you know, assuming...
Also known as what all gamers do when they see an unconscious individual loot the body.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. I mean, I could see he got out of the Sarlacc pit with the jetpack, that he was able to maybe fire the missile and then fly out. Like, maybe that was the play. And then he collapses and passes out, and Jabba strip him. Again, ugly imagery that I do not want to see on screen, but it makes you...
And less fun for this legal analysis, because yeah. like Tom was saying, if that's actually what happened, then our discussion about yeah. lost or abandoned property is going to get cut short.
It's stolen and...
Thieving Jawas.
Yeah. Jawas being bad. But again, then, yeah. but they didn't leave Vance to die. They picked him up.
Yeah.
So... like
that's why I'm leaning towards Gabby's theory
yeah.
that
yeah.
the Sarlacc somehow manages to spit the armor out and later Boba escapes somehow. I think they were hit. I think the thing with the crate dragon was like a big drop to trying to explain
yeah.
how Boba got out of there.
And I think because we don't know this is going way too in the weeds, but we don't know the digestion system of the Sarlacc, and there's several creatures are creatures on here on Earth that have two stomachs or have two, you know, a different than you know, different digestion systems than what we have. So it's totally possible that like the first stomach was like, no, Beskar, out and like keep meaty person to continue through. So
you stay. I like your hair.
Because if you think about it, think of what's left of the armor, right? You don't have the full Boba Fett suit. You just have the pieces of Beskar left over. Yeah. So it's I think that lends credence to the fact that he was kind of separated by yeah. the Sarlacc instead of like the jaw was just kind of like
it wasn't like trying to suck, you know, a human out of an eggshell.
Yeah.
It was like the bindings, all the pieces that
just
kind of
dissolved.
Stuck the armor together around the person mm-hmm. were probably dissolved, mm-hmm. right? So then all you have left are these pieces of armor. And then at that point, I don't know how much Boba sitting in the stomach of a, or second stomach of a Sarlacc is going to be able to do to prevent that from moving out the digestive
yeah.
tract.
There's also yeah. The fact that, it's supposed to take 1,000 years. He would turn to dust way faster than that. So are there some preservatives that keep the body fresh?
I don't want to get too deep into this because the answer is he has to be ingesting things in the digestive tract. Let's not go down that
path.
This
dark.
Is not what? The biology geeks, people.
No, but it should be. This is our pilot episode right here.
This is why we'd have expert witnesses to go, and now we'll discuss the biology of the Sarlacc, and, you know, and we
coming soon to an AP biology classroom near you.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, we swear them in, and we're off to the races, and yeah, so we rock.
But we would all have effective Daubert challenges raised against us
this
on this
true.
One. So.
This is true.
Yeah, but again,
well, so if his armor was spit out somehow, he's separated from it, then the question becomes, is it lost, or is it abandoned? And, you know, then ultimately, you know, what's the legal claim? Did the Jawas have some legal claim to it based on finding it like that? I have to assume that this is probably a handy dandy scavenging place for Jawas if they don't get too close, because if the Sarlacc is in the business of spitting out stuff that it
inedible
doesn't
things.
Like, there could be useful things. Or, you know, we know from canon that the wreckage of Jabba's sail barge was like a really big magnet, that there was a lot of valuable stuff there. Jawas and other folks on Tatooine were attracted to it like, you know, flies to honey because of all the the riches in that wreckage. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me at all that somebody came up on it. To me, I think it's reasonable for them to look at this blown up ship, all these dead bodies. You've got a Sarlacc there that's in the business and has been for a long time of eating people. This is probably abandoned or lost permanently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he's dead. Cause you're not going to see, there shouldn't be naked people on Tatooine in the desert. And cause that's just, that wouldn't make sense. It's twin sons.
There has to be a backstory behind this where he spends some time with the sand people.
Mm-hmm. if he did get out scantily clad, which again, disturbing, we got the wreckage of the sail barge. So, you know, he fashions an outfit maybe from leftover sail shreds and kind of does the Tarzan thing and, you know, slowly rebuilds his life, which again, why'd it take 7 years to get to the other half of Tatooine to say, like, dude, that's mine. I'm glad things have worked out. We can settle this right here and now. Look at the chain code. It's mine. You seem reasonable. Off to the races.
Which that's an important thing to note with either abandoned property or lost property. Is the person that you can be separated from something for an indefinite amount of time. And even if you claim it as yours, you will always lose your claim. Your claim always falls the current possessor of an item. Their claim always falls second to the true owner of a piece of property. So when Boba rolls up, whether he rolled up to the Jawas, whether he rolled up to Cobb Vanth, and now when he rolls up to Mando, as long as he says, yes, this is me, I am Boba Fett, this is mine, nobody can, you know, supersede that. Nobody can kind of trump that legal claim because he is the true owner of the armor, although it kind of varies of how he got the armor in the first place, but that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah, well discussed. Now let's highlight the Mandalorian recognizing Boba Fett was the rightful owner of it. And he said, like, oh, okay, it was your dad's. Okay, it's yours. Like, you know, you clearly are the right owner of it. And that touches on a state law in a nice way. And, you know, whether or not Jango had a will at the time of his beheading, you know, the fact that Boba...
Maybe that's what he was reading when he was like, he was reading the will. The will's in the helmet.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I get the chip. Yeah. No way.
As he shakes it, looks at it. Thanks, yes. Man. All bad. All.
Don't worry. I'll avenge you.
And we saw how that worked out. So.
I have gotten far enough in Clone Wars to know how that went.
Poorly.
Yeah. There was a high body count for vengeance. It's like, oh, did I? And I'm a kid. I feel bad about this as I've gotten older. It's like, but I was traumatized.
He killed a bunch of people who looked exactly like his father.
Yeah, and technically him. So.
How traumatic would that be? Okay.
Make good life choices, children. You know, don't get raised by a murderer. That's just. And I concede seeing your dad beheaded could mess you up in a variety of ways, especially if you are literally just a clone of your dad. So there's a lot to unpack there in a therapy session. But Mando recognizes this. And Tom, if do you want to take the will perspective? And Gabby, do you want to take the intestate succession perspective of how is Boba the rightful owner of that armor? And Tom, why don't we go with the easy path if there's a will?
Yeah, I mean, if there's a will, I think it's safe to assume from the context. And Jango seems like a pretty prepared guy. I would not be surprised at all if he took advantage of some legal assistance help there on Tipoca City at Camino and got a will drafted by a Kaminoan attorney, because I guess I'm going to assume those exist. And Jenga or Boba is his life. He has no spouse that we know of, no love interest, no other family that we know of. I mean, he's a foundling, so presumably, you know, the Mandalorian culture is his family, his fellow Mandalorians. So short of leaving something as a gift to Mandalorian society, I think it's safe to assume that if he had a will, everything that he owns that's of any value, particularly his armor, because that and the ship seem to be the most important pieces of his property, are going to go to Boba, his son. And that's perfectly normal. I think anybody that has kids out there, or, you know, if your parents have a will, you know, they're likely you're going to be a focus of it, or your kids are going to be a focus of your will. That's just natural. Now, if I don't know if you want me to take intestate succession, but I'm happy to bridge into that quickly if you want, Josh.
Actually, let's have Gab take.
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
If there's no will.
So intestate is what happens when you don't have a will. So the law has it set up so that if you pass away either suddenly or you don't have that nice whatever, an attorney from the plant, Kaminoan attorney, to draft a will for you, that your estate can be distributed. So this is kind of your natural, what is it? I think the term is something of your bounty. So this is your spouse and your heirs. So your children, your natural children, and obviously that's really all Django has. So the armor, any monies he has, was definitely going to go to Boba Fett after his beheading. If he didn't have Boba Fett as an heir, and obviously does not have a spouse, any property of his estate, including the armor, would cheat back to the state. But then it would be a question of what state does it cheat to? And that would, yeah. But I think
that's always the tricky.
The escheat to the state, if it escheats to Tatooine, some entity, legal entity on Tatooine, would give Cobb Vance another avenue to have legal claim to the armor.
Council of Jawas. Yeah. Do you have some trinket that we desire? Then it's hereby yours.
But yes, Gabby, I think you got all of that exactly right. It varies a little bit from state to state, but that's a generally true statement of how intestate succession works. I want to add the wrinkle here that we hope that that Django actually, you know, legally made Boba his child. Technically, as we know, he is not technically his child. He is, in fact, his clone. However, if he went through that process of legally adopting Boba, not just raising him as his own, then there is no difference between a biological child versus a legally adopted child in terms of how the inheritance works.
And that, the tricky thing with intestate succession, you know, in many cases like this, you know, single child, do you really need a will? Maybe not. If Django walks in and he says, well, I just want all my stuff to go to my son, I'm like, you know, I don't know that I would advise him to get a will, or that he would need a will in that moment. But there's an interesting wrinkle given their cultural background, because if Django did want something to go to, you know, back to Concord Dawn, or to say his covert, or you know, whatever they were, you know, at that point in time during Attack of the Clones, the intestate succession laws are not just going to assume that. And I don't know of any state that presumes any kind of intent to give a gift. If you look at most states, have sort of a formula and a way to figure out who amongst family is getting the property. And, you know, the state's not going to wade into trying to get into the mind of a dead person beyond just the four corners of those basic laws. And so, you know, if when I talk to clients in terms of estate drafting, that's always the question. Well, you know, if you want it to go straightforward, that's fine. Maybe you don't need a will in this case, but if there's any wrinkle to that at all, you're playing a risky game if you don't have a will.
which is just fascinating to dig into. Let's talk about the contract law here that really is messed up. So we got an issue of Boba Fett confronts the Mandalorian. Fennec has a gun trained on the child, who is protected by a force field, but that's beside the point at the moment. And that entire agreement has some big duress issues, because if I'm threatening to shoot your kid, there's really no bargaining. But it's ironically, it's Boba Fett who's the voice of reason, saying like, hey, let's everyone put down our weapons and just have a nice chat, which is like, I did not expect that.
He turned a new leaf inside the Sarlacc.
Yeah, he learned a lot being digested. He's more reflective. You know, after facing Luke Skywalker, he probably learned a lot with, like, let's try talking. And then the Imperials land, and everyone decides we're going to fight the space Nazis together, and which is what you do. Mm-hmm. So again, it gets a little weird fast with that. But let's dig into the legality of Fennec and Boba joining the fight in defense of the child, because they had put that out on the table of like, we'll help you, we want the kid safe. And to show you that we won't shoot him, which, again, so much to unpack there. But
they changed it from a contract to we won't kill the child to we will prevent anyone from killing the child, in which case that might be a valid contract exchange of services.
So
Mando ended up with a good deal. Yeah. I mean, you know, in spite of the threat of imminent death by sniper bolt.
But let's dig into... were they under, you know, was self-defense applicable to them? Because the Imperials didn't care. They were going to shoot anybody in their way. Nari, do you want to take the self-defense issues of...
Sure. So I think, as Tom has ably pointed out a few times, one of the keys to self-defense when it's defense of another, right? So we're assuming that this isn't just self-defense because the stormtroopers have showed up and are trying to kill Mando, or are trying to kill Fennec, or are trying to kill Boba. They're there to get the child. And I'm going to assume for purposes of this discussion that everyone understands that they are there to kidnap the child. In which case, in order to have a privilege to use force in self-defense of, or in defense of a third person, not yourself, you would need to be able to stand in that person's shoes, and you can exercise all force that that person would have been legally privileged to use. And in this case, you know, there's a little bit of attenuation when it comes to the facts, which is why I was saying, I'm just going to assume that everyone understands that they are about to commit a kidnapping of Grogu. If that is in fact the case, right? Let's simplify this down to Mando has Grogu in his van and someone is trying to grab him out of the van. Then you are legally privileged to use, or Mando would be legally privileged to use whatever force that Grogu would have been privileged to use. And in that case, Grogu is privileged to use force because he is, defending himself against a physically violent act. It's not clear that they're just like, we're just going to take him for a little walk. This is a serious threat to life.
We came with a mortar team.
Yeah. And this is something that I think we've talked about on this show a little bit before when it comes to like the Han shooting first thing. You know, in order to be justified in using force, even deadly force, you don't literally have to wait to be shot at. You have to be in reasonable fear for your life. In this case, Grogu is about to be the victim of a crime. He is in reasonable fear of his life. Mando is therefore legally justified in acting in his defense with potentially deadly force.
Yeah. And
Go ahead, Gabby.
No, I was going to say, I think it's clear that there's a kidnapping. I think at one point, one of the stormtroopers tells Fennec, like, you know, we're here for the child, you know, like, stand down. But I think the reason, like, I threw this into the outline was because the stormtroopers shoot first. Like, they roll up. They don't even say, like, that line of stand down, we're here for the child, comes, like, probably a good couple minutes into the battle, like they just roll up and start shooting. So even that you could take as an act of aggression against, you know, a threat of force against Fennec, against Boba Fett, against Mando. So they're defending themselves because they're being shot at. So they also have self-defense of themselves because they are being shot at by these stormtroopers.
Yeah, and I just want to point out that I think belatedly mentioning we are here to take the child would not constitute a timely notice that they are there to make a lawful arrest.
No, it's we're here to kidnap a little baby. And most people react with
So I don't want to cause us to fall down a rabbit hole, even though that caveat always causes us to fall down a rabbit hole.
It's like saying with all due respect, never something respectful.
Yeah, and then it's good. I'm going to immediately say something that's very disrespectful. There's an interesting wrinkle if you consider, you know, presume that this imperial force has some legal authority, that they're acting in a law enforcement capacity. And you could go way into a deep dive discussion about the state of galactic politics and, you know, Gideon and whether this scrap of Imperials has any authority. You know, we've gone down that path a ways before. But generally speaking, you know, you don't have a right to self-defense against a law enforcement officer acting within the scope of their job. You know, there are some exceptions, right? But generally, if the police officer is doing what they're supposed to be doing, not aka not being Denzel Washington in Training Day, you don't get to take advantage of the normal sort of escape hatches in terms of using force and self-defense. You know, somebody that fires back at the police during a traffic stop, doesn't get to claim self-defense if, you know, the officer was justified in shooting in the first place. So, you know, in that sense, it's an interesting wrinkle. I mean, you know, I think we can, we just talked about they come right off of those landing craft firing. So there's probably some question, but you know, they've got you think about it from the stormtrooper's perspective, as sympathetic as it is, you've got a highly wanted Jedi fugitive, very dangerous, despite his diminutive size up on this rock. And then you've got one of the most, you've got one of the most dangerous fugitives in like blaster proof armor down defending him. And then they don't know it at the time, but a pair of other deadly defenders also helping him. You know, I don't know that it's unreasonable for them to come out blasters blazing, so to speak, but I don't think they had any legal authority here. So that's
more probably an aside. Moreover, the defenders held the high ground. They should have learned.
Yeah, the classic Star Wars idiot mistake.
We need to be higher than them. We've learned from this. Just be glad there's no lava. So no, we're not going. As soon as you say I'm here for the child, no, you're not. Yeah. Everyone's going to lock and load at that point because
we're here for that 50-year-old.
It's like, yeah, even then, it's like, yeah, but you want to go beat up a 50-year-old? Like, what the hell did he do? Yeah,
it's either child abuse or senior abuse. Yeah. So, like, there's no winning there.
No.
50, define what's his species? I need that information to evaluate this claim here.
So let's get to what was one of the hardest parts of this to watch, because there are two troubling scenes here. So is the dark troopers descending and getting him. And this is where I will raise, why the hell didn't Mando pick up his jetpack? Because if Boba Fett has enough time to do a costume change, why didn't he pick the Mandalorian, grab his jetpack and fly up the hill? Because
and it seems like it snaps on and snaps off. That this is not like a thing that he has to like buckle in and all that kind of
stuff. It's remote controlled.
Yeah. So like, yeah, he could call it back.
He could make it fly to him.
Yeah. What the hell? So, and I'm going to be super disgusted if they just lost it and left it. It's like, well, that's lazy storytelling of, you know, like have it get shot. Like have it be.
Yeah, that would have been a completely believable thing, is for there to be an initial brief shootout with the three of them, resulting in damage, at least temporary damage, that his jetpack isn't operable. It would have been way more sensical.
Yeah, because they don't want him being able to get up the hill fast. So, like, that's the reason to get him out of the jetpack. But as soon as the Imperials land, he should have picked it up. Because that, and the fact that he doesn't seem able to learn, wow, it threw me back once when I tried to get my kid. I'm going to try again and hope for a different result. He's smarter than that. So, like, those were my gripes with the storytelling. It focuses on the jetpack. That said, he gets kidnapped. You know, I don't know exactly if the Dark Troopers are reanimated clones that have had their limbs cut off or not, but, you know, if they're kind of RoboCop-esque, which would suck for them. But again, they're kind of that scary Vader look. Who wants to talk about kidnapping the most adorable child in all of Star Wars? Nari, you look super sad.
Don't make me sad.
Are you okay? I'm not worried. Get.
I'm happy to talk. I'm unhappy to talk about this. So.
Own it. It's yours. So.
So the key elements of the kidnapping crime are unlawful taking of a victim and nefarious motive. In this case, I'm pretty sure we've got both. The intent of the kidnapper is pretty decisive. I mean, the intent in any crime is usually pretty decisive. In this case, it's, you know, not for ransom, which is perhaps what the normal kidnapping motive would be. It's to essentially make someone an involuntary medical experiment subject. Either way, I'm pretty confident this is for nefarious motive. And this is, of course, also physical taking. It's not from a home, but it is from a guardian. I'm pretty confident this qualifies as forceful taking of an individual for nefarious purposes. Does anyone want to be in the Empire Remnants defense lawyer?
I mean, look, we can be honest with ourselves. Every motive that Giancarlo Esposito has is nefarious.
Yeah,
so there's not much wiggle room for him.
He has no non-nefarious impulses.
No nefarious motives.
Yeah. This is the guy who enlists the war crimes he committed as his introduction to let you know he plays to win. So
I have him printed on a card if you would like to keep it for reference in the future.
I love that the actor himself has said in an interview that his kids were obsessed with Baby Yoda. And he was like, I'm going to just like kidnap that pointy-eared bastard. And I was just like, that's method. That's really, really method. There's a spectrum to actors on The Mandalorian. There's Werner Herzog and Giancarlo Esposito. Everybody else is in the middle. Yeah, right. Like that's the spectrum.
Watching him on Mando Mondays and other interviews, I really want to hang out and barbecue with that dude. He seems fun and cool. Yeah.
Everybody wearing capes.
Yeah, it's just
mandatory.
No, wear the cape. Don't let it wear you. Yeah.
You also grow a mustache and you just, you know, like ask him casually, like, I mean, do you like my mustache? Is it?
do you approve?
I'll tee this question up for Nari. I think I know the answer to it. But does the fact that he uses an autonomous robot, so it's not Gideon flying down and snatching up Baby Yoda from Tython, it's a lifeless being, you know, a drone, if you will, doing it. Does that absolve him of anything? Is that degree of separation? Does it get him off in this instance?
You know, if someone wanted to, you know, be a defense lawyer and really earn their fee when it came to defending the Empire, you might be able to mount a defense that they did so against the wishes of the of Moff Gideon. But that would pretty much be the only way you could make that make a difference, is if it were a malfunctioning droid.
Yeah.
Because that would negate the intent part. The part though where, you know, you're using a tool to do the act of unlawfully taking, I don't think that's going to affect that in any way. Of course we, oh, sorry, Gabby, I see you want to start talking.
No, I was going to say, you couldn't even make that argument that they were somehow autonomous or somehow not in control Rogue. Of Moff Gideon, because there's a specific scene where he asks his underlings,
yep.
have the dark troopers been
deployed,
whatever, deployed or whatever. Later. Yeah. So he's clearly in control of these guys. There's no possible argument to make that he is not the one, he is not the puppeteer controlling their strings. So in that sense, the dark troopers are an extension of him. I think the only way the Empire gets, or Remnant, or whatever Moff Gideon's forces are, gets off in this scenario is if they can claim that authority that we were discussing earlier, that this is an arrest and not
right.
A kidnapping.
In which case it would not be an unlawful taking, right? So that's a qualifier in the actus reus of this crime.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, every time law enforcement detains someone, it is not a kidnapping.
Yeah.
Look, if the Allentown, Pennsylvania police start using dark troopers on our streets, I'm going to figure out which of your cities I'm going to move to. Yeah.
and how many SWAT teams are used to arrest a toddler? Like, yeah. Okay, that
50 years old.
Toddler, still looks like a toddler, still acts like a toddler.
In possession of deadly weapons, meaning the Force.
Toddler who thinks and acts.
Yeah.
And we see Baby Yoda go to work with the Force in this one.
He does use them as playthings. And
and we see a Force choke. I'm pretty sure there was a Force choke going on, wasn't there? Do I remember that correctly?
Well, they were threatening him, so I mean, like,
No. I'm not saying it was unjustified. But this is, I think, the first time we really see him, you know, manipulating the Force with that intent to do at least some type of violence, right? We've seen him like push things.
Yeah,
I don't know that we've seen him, you know, literally grab. And like, I guess, no, we did. He started force choking in season one. That's right.
Yeah.
So I take it back. But this is definitely one of the most intense times that we've seen Baby Yoda use the Force as a weapon.
Which makes sense. I've just been kidnapped from my dad. Yes. These dudes are trying to hurt me.
Yes. This is just
it's like, use of force. Yeah, I'm going to
say that. Use of the Force.
Yes. Justified. It's just
that's what I'm here for.
I think the most heartbreaking shot though is not when they take Baby Yoda, but when Mando looks through his visor and like catches the dark troopers in the air, and it just like zooms into Baby Yoda's face. His ears, flapping. He's just like, "Daddy, save me."
When there's that, like, that tone, it's not part of the soundtrack, I don't think, but it's like that tone that plays that's like, it's almost putting an audio version to like your hair standing up on the back of your neck, like you, or that your stomach, the pit dropping out of your stomach.
So this is my prediction. I believe Mando is going to refer to the child as his son at some point in time. Perhaps fighting Moff Gideon with, "I'm taking my son, I'm here for my son." Something along...
I don't think I can handle that.
Something along those lines for breaking out the whoop-ass lamp. And because it's just like, nope, I'm here for my boy. And
I'm going to take a half bet against you, just to make it a little interesting. I'm going to bet that he calls him my child instead of the child.
The internet will break that day.
My heart will like just
I'm okay. It's like, you know, like that would work too. I consider that he will show familiar ownership or connection in a serious way of like, "I'm the dad here," which is why I'm looking forward to, you know, the dad off of, you know, it's it's like, nope, I'm putting together a team and we're gonna go whoop ass. So just a couple thoughts. So when we see Cara Dune and she looks up Mayfield, you know, Mando says, like, hey, I want to go break him out and use him. I really hope that Dune's reaction is, I'm a rebel or a rebellion marshal now. So, or excuse me, Republic marshal now. Let's just call him back up. And like we call people, and because we got some X-wing pilots who are hanging around who want to help out. So two. But they probably have friends. So like we call them.
Do they though?
Yeah, that's
a fair question.
The Republic and this show seems pretty strapped for people and cash.
I would call it in and go like, hey, we got some Imperials that need killing, and they kidnapped a baby. Who's on board? Like that normally should rally troops for like, who wants to go save a baby from space Nazis? And most people should giddy up at that point for like, it's been a while.
I don't know.
Been a while.
They squabbled over getting together to go blow up the planet killing weapon that was going to wipe them out.
That was 25 years in the future from where we are. So like,
Yeah.
And that was after they had 25 years to build up the
new
Republic.
So the first generation of people who liberated everyone from the Empire, they're still around. So you still got people with a backbone, with, as if you will, cojones, that can say, no, we're going to go in and we're not going to wait for this to be a problem. We're not, you know, the French letting the Germans build up their armaments again. No, we're going to stop this crap once and for all. So again, the real men are still alive at this point. So.
I just want to point out, we don't know what's going on in the rest of the galaxy. We know that Thrawn is out there somewhere. There could be very serious mischief or even war that is happening elsewhere outside of these Outer Rim planets. That could be it could explain why they've got the two pilots, and every time they call in for backup, they get someone on the other line saying, "I'm sorry, try again tomorrow."
But okay, I totally can see them fighting skirmishes, which also does wonders for future seasons, because it's like, so there's still another governor out there in this quadrant doing their Imperial thing. Cool. So more mop up duty, game on. Great storytelling opportunities. But I'm fine with calling the support.
I have a theory, and I hope they don't call in the New Republic, because what I would like to see by the time they get, because obviously the next couple episodes is going to be them rallying the forces. And I think what would be great to see is kind of a reflection of how Din Djarin was found in the flashbacks we saw last season, and kind of replicate that with, I mean, you already have three Mandalorians on board. You have Din, you have Bo-Katan, you have Boba Fett, and, you know, hopefully we can find some others, and to have them kind of come together and save Baby Yoda, this foundling, that and maybe like have Ahsoka pop up and just be like, kick some ass, and that would be great. That would just be.
Yeah. And let's not forget that the New Republic is not what it was military wise during Jakku or like right afterwards. They've enacted at Mon Mothma's behest, the Military Disarmament Act. The military force that they have is a tiny fragment of what it was. I mean, they've demilitarized by this point. You know, they still have some forces out there, like at least two X-Wings, I guess. But, you know, they don't have the offensive strike capability that they might have at Endor or at Jakku. So, and that's also too convenient. I mean, you know, narratively, I think that's too convenient. As satisfying as it would be to see like a Mon Cal cruiser jump in and just like obliterate Gideon, I think it's going to be a lot cooler. Like Gabby's thought is like exactly what's been percolating in my mind. Like, let's get Bossk, let's get Dengar, let's get all the old bounty hunters together, this like crew of misfits, you know, with a lot of death and killing under their belt, get them together. What popped into my mind is they're searching for Mayfeld is like, this is a nascent conspiracy forming, you know, before our very eyes. Yes. You've got a New Republic law enforcement officer of some type, some authority. She's got a badge, so I guess that's all you need. And you know, so you've got two people, and they're you know, agreeing to commit a crime, you know, if you want to consider this, I guess the act of breaking him out is a crime.
The prison break, that's
yeah.
a crime.
Well, yeah, I was saying the act of attacking this stupid, you know, war criminals cruiser is not, but the yeah. So all we need now is just an overt act, and you know, maybe we get that in the next episode. Get our conspiracy fleshed out.
I would rather go to the New Republic and say we need him so we can go kill some space Nazis, and they say okay, like that too could work. And I do like the Dirty Dozen type idea of he would rally who he knows. So that would be the other Mandalorians. And that's also fan service for working in all the bounty hunters from Empire Strikes Back who didn't do anything except stand there on Vader's Star Destroyer. So like it narratively can work and it could be super brutal seeing those guys beat the snot out of some Imperials. I think that would be emotionally satisfying, which is what we...
I was just going to add, and so far in the first season, and we're seeing again in the second season, there's this interesting narrative style in which for the first, you know, several episodes, you seem to have these self-contained stories, but, you know, Mando and Grogu are building these relationships with people that they meet along the way, and eventually they run into a problem that Mando can't solve on his own, and those people that they've developed those friendships with and those affections with come in to help them at the end, sometimes at great personal cost, as we saw in the last one. So I wouldn't necessarily put myself down for this will be, they'll just go in and kick Imperial butt. There could be some characters that get some sacrifice along the way. So yeah, we'll have to see what happens.
I think what would be cool to see is if they bring, because we don't know what other characters because they could bring like a Sabine Wren in or an Ezra Bridger in the next couple episodes. And I think what would be cool to see if all they brought in was Ezra, if that's the Jedi who heard the call from the Seeing Stone, if you see this kind of battle on an Imperial cruiser or wherever they happen to end up fighting Moff Gideon, Mandalorians and Jedi fighting alongside each other, it would be a good callback to the quote from both the trailers and from the end of last season, which was the armor saying, you know, there's tales that tell of Mandalore the Great battling with an order of sorcerers known as Jedi. So to kind of flip that and say, instead of battling each other, they're now fighting on the same side for the same goal, for the greater good. I think that would be kind of narrative, but that's just me being, you know, my
very narratively.
You're trying to scratch my fan itch here. Yes.
It would work. And it's a big nothing if the Seeing Stone had no one show up, because somebody had to hear that, whether it was Luke or Ezra, and the idea of de-aging Mark Hamill to go in, while emotionally satisfying, they're just not going to do it. So
I'm still hoping for Mace Windu.
Yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson thinks he survived.
Crazy with a capital C.
Somebody had to get him out of there. And if it was Mace after losing an arm, but again, that seems out of character for Mace to like just abandon the fight overall, that he wouldn't roll over and just admit defeat. He would rally forces. So I think that's why he's dead. That said, Ezra would be cool, because there has to be a Calvary type show up with a Jedi, and we just I think it would make sense if they came from animation, because that would, again, Sabine and Ezra as foster parents works, or again, it's we'll see. That said, this is fun. I know we're going to get more. And, you know, before we close out, there are a couple other issues. We see Boba Fett again. They fix him just standing around. He's brutal. But he uses a stick to beat up stormtroopers. Armor shatters. Those guys die horribly. It's worse than Endor. Do we have defective body armor? Because it's supposed to, you know, fight, you know, not shatter from a stick. And Tom,
I think the base question of whether a stormtrooper even has legal standing to sue for his body armor. Generally, U.S. service members are barred by something called the Fairies Doctrine from pursuing legal claims, at least against the government, for anything that's service connected. And generally, you know, I don't know of any lawsuits, successful ones, by a service member against, you know, like a manufacturer of a product. But my take on it is that the stormtrooper armor isn't meant to be impenetrable. It's meant to increase survivability. So just like, you know, the steel helmets that soldiers wore in World War II, I mean, that's not going to stop a direct round. It might help deflect a little bit of shrapnel. Even just like the Kevlar vests that we wear now, that's not going to stop everything. It you know, certainly is not going to protect you from every single thing. We don't want it to be defective and say shatter at the slightest like little breeze. But the whole point of all of this stuff is to just increase the chances that you will survive some sort of wound that you take on the battlefield. And I think, you know, it's going to be hard for any manufacturer to warn against like blunt force trauma delivered by a like an expertly trained Mandalorian wielding this like, you know, ancient weapon from Tatooine. You know, I think if I were the manufacturer, I'd say, you know, there are a billion weapons in this galaxy, and we can guarantee you that you have an increased likelihood of living through most injuries, but there's no way we can warrant it against everything. So that was like one of the most brutal Star Wars scenes, I think, in anything we've seen on film. But I don't think that poor crumpled stormtrooper or his family has any real cause of action here.
Yeah, I mean, you hear him die like that.
I can't even contort myself into that position.
You hear it get sunk into him. It's like, whoa, that had to hurt.
And it's important to note that staff or whatever that weapon is called that Boba Fett is wielding has a spear on both ends. So when he goes down and he swings it around and you see it, that the acorn part, for lack of a better term, pointed spear, like curved spear on it. So that can also kind of shatter armor. And he's putting a lot of power behind it. I mean, to me, I was never really obsessed with Boba Fett. I never got it. I never understood it. I thought it was overhyped. And I think in that scene, they made us believe why Boba Fett was so cool, because that was amazing. That scene for me was on par with the ending of Rogue One, with Darth Vader just annihilating this whole quarter of soldiers. I thought it was just brilliant. But he's putting a lot of physical power behind those swings. We don't know how heavy that staff is, because it could be, you know, pretty solid.
Gabby, now that you mention it, I should say, for the folks that are just listening to this, I will make you a special offer this one time on this cool 6-inch Boba Fett figure. Now that he's an attractive character to you, I think you ought to have this in your personal collection. So see me after the recording and we'll make it.
Well played. He's also fairly strong for a guy who's probably in his 50s. He like picks the stormtrooper up by the neck with one hand. Like there's
got that old man strength.
Yeah. He's old for a reason. Like there's
he's hit the gym a bit since getting out of the Sarlacc.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lifting a few Jawas over his head, I presume, searching for his armor.
How many can you bench press? Yeah, there's he did okay. Now,
I see someone added to the outline something that is just making me giggle, which is there legal liability for Baby Yoda throwing stormtroopers around?
Look,
who added that?
That's look, those two guards were unarmed and just getting
I'm sorry. Those bastards ground, like, deserved pieces. It.
They're like little popcorn kernels, you know, bouncing around in the microwave.
So assuming
that was satisfactory when they crunched against the, when they crunched heads and crunched back against the walls. Justification.
The look on Moff Gideon's face was priceless.
Assuming that this isn't justified use of the Force, which I really love, and instead, like, let's imagine, right, that Baby Yoda has just been left here for a minute by Mando, who's off to go to the DMV, and he starts throwing some people around. This brought to mind, you know, tort law and how it applies to children. So, in general...
You're welcome.
Yes. And if he is in fact considered legally a child, right, because he's 50 years old, but in general, the torts of children are held liable against the child, not the parent. There are exceptions to that. And generally speaking, also, there's a more lenient standard when it comes to the reasonable person standard. So people who don't know the basics of tort law, the really basic gist of it is that if you are liable to a person who you harm, if you committed an act and did not take reasonable care in doing so, and that resulted in the person's injury. So, but the standard of reasonable care is different when a child is doing it. It's instead like a reasonable child, if I remember my 1L tort law correctly, except if the child is doing something that generally an adult would only do, like using, I don't know, hazardous things, materials, driving a car. I'm gonna hazard a guess here that using the Force is an adult's activity, like driving a car. It's inherently dangerous. Even though in theory a child could do it, they probably shouldn't without adult supervision. So Baby Yoda here would probably be on the hook under a reasonable care standard as an adult. Lastly, some states will hold parents financially liable, even though the child is the one who is technically the tortfeasor. So Mando might be on the hook for all of those.
You know, there's such a thing as jury nullification, and I have a feeling the moment that they see little Baby Yoda on like 5 phone books at defense table, there's no chance for plaintiffs.
There's another factor here. Those bastards kidnapped him.
Yeah, yeah. So none of this matters.
True.
This is true.
So he's trying to get away from his kidnappers,
yeah,
who are war criminals. People are going to be way okay with, did you smack him to the left or to the right? Okay,
smack them into each other.
Yeah,
the jury and then is the going wall. To send the question to the council. Can you please tell us again how Baby Yoda escaped in greater detail?
Look, physics is the real culprit here. I just sort of started them on a path, and then they got in each other's way, and then the walls were right there. So
maybe if they hadn't kidnapped me, none of this would have happened to them. So,
but for them kidnapping me, they would not have been injured.
Yeah. And then you throw in the menacing done by Moff Gideon, which, again, such a good villain.
So good.
But holding a lightsaber up to a child, do you remember these? Yeah, it's just, it's like, dude, you're a jerk. Like, it's just.
But also, those were some good lines. I don't think you're ready to play with this yet. Liable to put an eye out.
It's like a total Christmas story moment.
Yeah, it's
ho, ho, ho.
Which actually, I found out after this episode that apparently the guy that played Ralphie is a good friend of Jon Favreau and was actually in Iron Man. And so he and Jon Favreau like go way back. And so that might have been a direct callback to Christmas Story. And we may get more.
Yeah. That is a great nugget.
That's a great nugget.
Yeah. Ralphie plays the main elf, not Papa Elf, but the
former. That's right.
Yeah, he's.
Yeah.
Which stormtrooper is he?
Yeah, I think he's got to be one.
He plays.
The one getting choked.
In Iron Man, he plays the guy, the scientist that. What's his name's character? The bad guy in Iron Man, the first Iron Man.
Stane?
Yes. Yells at and that about, you know, a box of scraps. That guy. that scientist.
Oh,
man.
Oh wow.
That little
good callback.
Weasley scientist, yes. That guy is the actor that played Ralphie in A Christmas Story.
The more you know.
Nicely done.
So yeah, he's
a good way.
Yeah.
He has to have a cameo.
I think Gabby wins this week's nerd trivia contest.
I cannot take credit for that. I found that on the internet somewhere. So like that is not my observation.
Outstanding. Well, we're gonna have a traumatic week, and so this goes what
they can't go all week without knowing what happened to Baby Yoda.
5 whole days. Whoa.
It's again brilliant. We care about a puppet, you know, that is so well done.
And he started making sounds now too. When he tips over and he's like, ah.
Yeah, it's again, I look forward to the Mandalorian, you know, fact that he'll
Dadalorian.
He'll own it and he'll go get my boy and the world will be with him. It's like, yeah, go ahead. Smack him around. He's a bad guy. You can tell he's wearing all black and has the fake Vader chest gauntlet thing. So
and he has a mustache.
Again, the
slick, always an indicator of a bad guy.
The slick back hair. Yeah, it's just so well done. And he seems so nice in interviews. Oh, gotta love that. So with that, everyone, thanks for tuning in. We'll be back with more. And if you enjoy what you hear, please leave a review, shoot us a note, and everyone, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you soon. Take care.